Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Welcome to the IGN UK podcast. I think we've got a sexy tone going on this week with two incredibly, I would say furiously, attractive gentlemen in Jesse Gomez.
Hello there, thank you.
And the just delectable Matt Purslow.
Oh, thank you, Simon. What people, I don't think people necessarily know what kind of like hair Jesse's got going on at the moment. He's got the fullest beard that I've seen him ever wear. And when I saw him in person the other day, like longer, like almost like Geralt at short length hair.
Ooh.
It's very, very
luscious.
We've
got our very own Witcher in the midst. Been slaying any beasts lately, Jesse?
Not quite, mate, but I have been playing a lot of Slayer.
Have you?
Are you
trying to do a segue there?
I wanted to throw my hat in the ring. Yeah, let's talk about Halo Infinite Multiplayer.
Oh, are you hosting that? Go on then, let's go for it.
That's me done. It's over
okay,
to you now.
Halo Multiplayer dropped. What was it, last Friday now?
Tuesday,
I can't remember the exact day.
It was only this Tuesday.
Jesus, it feels like longer than that, because I have been spending half of my time since playing it. but yeah, dropped out of nowhere. No one knew that was coming, did they? Didn't leak at all. Wasn't a surprise. Yeah, I've been playing a lot of Halo Multiplayer, and here's maybe it may shock some people. Others, they may not care. But yeah, the first time I ever played Halo Multiplayer was this Tuesday, and I've been playing it, like I said, pretty much non-stop since. It is fantastic. I'll preface this, but I'm probably about to say a lot of points about why Halo Multiplayer is great that people have been saying for about 19 years now. But, look, I'm new to it, and I'm sure a lot of people will be new to it, because obviously Game Pass, you don't even need Game Pass, do you? I think it's just free for anyone.
That is really, really good.
You don't even need Xbox Live, do you? It's just, you just play it whenever you want. Matt, you are much more versed in Halo than I. Why, in particular, is Halo Infinite Multiplayer so good?
So, I think the main thing that, like, if you haven't played a Halo multiplayer before, is that coming to this in an era post Call of Duty, kind of redefining what kind of like multiplayer shooters are a little bit. It's much more closer to the old school arena style multiplayers that kind of like were popularized by Quake and things. So there are two broad kind of types of multiplayer matches in this. There are the big team battles, which are 12v12, right?
Yeah.
And then there are the smaller ones, which are 4v4. The smaller ones are generally in symmetrical, quite contained maps, very kind of corridory with lots of like sharp corners, multiple different levels, and everybody on the team will always start with the same like loadout, which is the assault rifle and a pistol. And a big part of the game is, whilst there will be an objective going on, so that might be capture points, it's got a classic capture the flag mode. It's got a game called Oddball, which is literally pick up a ball, in this case a skull, and hold on to it for as long as possible until your team gets 100 points. But the big kind of thing that creates the interesting wrinkles in this is that there will be weapons that spawn on the map, and it's about the team that can hold on to those spawn points and be the people that know, like, I know that the rocket launcher is going to spawn in like 15 seconds. I'm going to get there. I'm going to lock down the point. I'm going to get the rocket launcher.
Please give it its full name, the Spanker.
It's called the Spanker, yes. And literally, like, it's S-P-N-K-R or something like that. But
yeah,
your,
no vowels in,
yeah,
in this
your
game.
Your AI companion refers to it as the Spanker. And yeah, so then you get something like that, or the Cinder Shot, or like these big kind of powerful weapons. And like the team that controls them generally is the team that will have the edge. Doesn't mean that they'll win. Like, tactics obviously are also a big part, but that kind of like classic thing where everybody starts on even footing, and then it's about who best understands how those map works, and yeah. and how to lock down specific I areas of it. That's where
that's why I'm particularly loving the 4v. I mean, I'm loving all the modes, but the 4v4 modes are singing to me a lot more. And I know it's probably going to be design wise and historically the other way around completely, that they borrowed from them. But like the 4v4 modes basically do remind me of Overwatch, because it's all about map knowledge. It's about and it's kind of, it's obviously less ability based than Overwatch, but you're kind of almost getting those abilities on the fly, like you said, by finding the rocket launcher, finding these weapons, finding like overshields, which like basically give you double health. Like it's about basically creating, it's almost like a hero shooter on the fly in a way, which is I suppose is what arena shooters are at their core anyway. But that's why I'm liking the 4v4 modes, and the fact that it is, although you do have Slayer, which is basically team deathmatch first to 50 kills, like objectives, I do like objective based multiplayer. That's why I've always liked Overwatch and Light Siege, because I like having that, you know, basically tactical awareness to it. And Halo is kind of, you obviously do have tactics, but at the same time it doesn't punish you if you do just want to go a bit rogue and go and kill.
Like ultimately, like your team might lose, but you know, kind of like there is that, it's because the time to kill in Halo is substantially higher than a lot of other games. Like I'd say it's arguably even higher than some Overwatch characters, right? Like
Apart from tanks, it's close to a tank.
But you obviously have to drill through an overshield, you know, like a force field that surrounds a Spartan, and then you have to get the kill on the Spartan itself. So compared to Call of Duty, like you are fighting a lot longer, which means those kind of like moving around in little packs is very, very advantageous. Kind of like two on one, it's always going to be the two that pretty much gets that firefight dealt with. Whereas I think Call of Duty lets you, like, if you're really good on the Twitch, you can take two people out.
It's all about reflex, isn't it, Call of Duty? Because the time scale is so short. Basically, if you fire first, you win. Like, it's the it's the Greedo Han Solo of multiplayer games, whereas Halo is much more like the Battle of Naboo. I don't know, I was trying to find a, find a metaphor.
You just have a better chance when you're playing if someone comes up behind you and you're going around a corner, you let your shield charge a little bit and stuff. And also there's some, I don't know if this is new to Halo Infinite, because I know when I played Halo 3 and Reach, like Mantlin, for example, that just makes the game feel a little bit more modern, because, you know, when you're playing multiplayer prior to these games, if you're in a tough spot and you're having a hard time trying to jump over something and someone comes behind you, you're gone. But at least here it feels a bit more modern, brings the game up to, I guess, speed with other comparable modern
shooters.
You have,
like, a micro chance to pull yourself up to safety, because the levels are kind of quite tiered. So there's generally always, everywhere you are, like an opportunity to either jump up or jump down, which obviously then kind of comes in very much with the grapple hook, right? Like if you can find the grapple hook.
God, that feels so good to use.
I think it only, like in multiplayer, it only comes with, I think you can fire it three times, is it?
Yeah,
before
I think
it disappears.
So, three. Yeah.
But like having that does, like we all know from Titanfall 2, well, I say we all know from Titanfall 2, nobody fucking played Titanfall 2, did they? But if you played that game, you know how like transformative having a grapple hook can be in multiplayer, and I think Halo does that very well.
Yeah,
I just love that it's kind of 99% skill based. Like if you if you're good at a game, you will do well. Like there's not a lot of luck to it. Like we said, it's, you're not picking loadouts. There's no real meta to, like, kind of like, you know, Call of Duty is all about finding the right suppressor for the right gun, and like, whereas this is, everyone's on an even playing field. Like incredibly well designed maps. Not a ton of them at the moment, but like enough for a launch that is, you know, it's not getting stale at all, and just. Yeah, it's all about, and like I said, even if you shoot first, you're not guaranteed to win that fight, because it's all about like holding that recoil. And normally, like if you're very accurate, you'll have enough in a full clip to take someone down. But more often than not, you'll either have to go for the melee or switch weapons to get to finish off that kill. And it's just about, for the first 2 hours, I wasn't doing very well, because I was trying to play it like Call of Duty or Battlefield. Whereas, you've got to get in that rhythm of like, right, I'm going to use my assault rifle to get their shield off, then go in for the melee to finish them off. And like just finding that rhythm is just, it's very satisfying. And then again, I'm saying something that people have literally been doing for 20 years. Yeah. But it's just so fun.
Grenade tactics as well, right? Like there's so much more grenade throwing in Halo than pretty much any other multiplayer shooter.
It just feels like a game that really benefits having like a fun team to play with. Like when we were playing yesterday, like, you know, capture the flag, like someone was getting in the car and meeting up with someone else as you're running towards each other, just at least that moment are just so fun like that.
I barely used any vehicles at the moment, but like I feel like I should be doing it more, because whenever anyone gets in like one of the flying wasps and stuff,
you get fucked up.
I don't know, I'm, it's just very, very fun. Like obviously it's by no means perfect. Like, there's been a lot of talk, and they're already addressing it to an extent. The battle pass progression is not the best I've seen in the game. It's very slow, and the fact that it's all challenge based, though, didn't they last night, I think, introduced you get 50 XP
for playing a game? Yeah, which means that, like, it still doesn't, like, so I don't own the battle pass and don't necessarily intend on buying it, and so my battle pass is going up very, very slowly. Even with that 50 points for playing a match, it's a very, mm-hmm. very slow progression. Yeah. The main thing for me is kind of like, I'm less fussed about the cosmetic side of it. Like, mm-hmm. And there's nothing else that you need in that game. Like, the entire game is designed to be played without a progression system. Like, all the progression happens within the confines of a match.
Yeah. I do think if they added more, I mean, maybe that is, I haven't looked if it's part of progression or if you earn them through doing the campaign, but like, one cool thing would be like getting different voices for your AI companion, like, especially if they got like celebrity voices. And I'm imagining, do you remember when Rage put Danny Dyer in as a voice? Like, something like that. Just some mad voices in there as your AI companion, because they are like, they could so easily be very annoying to have constantly going off in your ear, but they are actually a great combination of useful and also just quite funny.
Yeah, I think it surprised me how good the contextual, like, awareness dialogue is. So the context, for anybody that hasn't played it yet, there's the match announcer that does all of the kind of like how many points you've got and stuff like that, but your Spartan has a personal AI, which is effectively their version of Cortana, that will do call outs, and sometimes when it's able to like literally call out, like, there's an enemy below you.
Yeah.
Like, that suddenly becomes very, very useful. And obviously that is not based on like other people have to have been able to see that person, and it's very much like how Overwatch works. Like, if someone on the team notices a sniper in Overwatch, their character will shout out "sniper." And Halo has a very, very similar system, but it is very well put together.
Exactly. That's why it reminds me of Overwatch so much. Like, obviously, Overwatch must have borrowed a lot from Halo historically, but like, yeah, this Halo is definitely borrowed from Overwatch in that regard. Like, there is a ping system in Halo, but I'm hardly ever using it. Like, I'm only ever using it if I literally have a challenge, which is ping someone and then kill them. Like, the ping system, like, there's a lot, you know, it's quite, for also quite an objective-based game, it's quite a frantic game, I suppose, like Overwatch. Like, it's not like a Siege, it's not like a slow-paced out game. Like, it's quite frantic, and yeah, I'm just, I think most of all, like, the biggest compliment you can pay is just, it's just ridiculously fun, and that's sometimes all you want from a game. It's just, this is fun. Like, although I do have the battle pass, I'm not like, it's not, it shows a lot when I'm playing a game, and like, that's the same thing with Overwatch, is that like, I'm playing the game to enjoy the game rather than like some games, I don't know, like Warzone, it'd be like, oh, I'm playing this game just to get to the next level of the battle pass, because it's something I want. Like, I'm not necessarily playing this game because it's the game I want to play right now, but like, yeah, Halo, I just want to pop it on and play it. Just like, I think we were saying yesterday, like, it's a sign of a great game that even when you're losing and playing badly, you're just still having a great time. Like, I'm not getting annoyed because it's so skill-based, you only have yourself to blame. It's not like, there's nothing unfair about that game, I don't think. It's not like, oh, that guy had this ability.
Yeah, no one's coming in with, like, mad pre-order bonuses and stuff that buff them up mid-match or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't wait to play more. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about Halo in the future, but for now, that's enough multiplayer. Matt, you have had the privilege of being able to play, what, the first four missions of the campaign?
I have, yes. And I'm delighted to say it's absolutely fantastic. Nice. I really like this. And so I think we've briefly spoken about this before on podcasts where there wasn't a huge amount to talk about, but over this year I've been playing the Halo campaigns again, kind of like some of them for the first time. You know, the first replay I've done of them since they originally came out. And so to play them all back to back, you really notice kind of like the evolution of that series, and also how much of a catastrophic drop off Halo 5 is. Halo 5 is a bad campaign. Like, genuinely.
I wouldn't know.
Why was
it bad? Give us a little background. So, Halo, what went wrong?
Halo 5, like, thematically and like story driven, is a dreadful story campaign. It follows Halo 4, which I think is a very, very good campaign, and really demonstrated that, hey, after Bungie leaving kind of like Halo as a franchise, it felt like it had moved into good hands, at least on the campaign side. I didn't actually play a lot of Halo 4 multiplayer, but I know that was less well received. But the Halo 4 campaign is genuinely quite good. It's a little bit more constrained than the previous Bungie Halos have been, but it does take the good, some good ideas from Call of Duty in that, like, that cinematic first-person perspective, and also, like, honed the storyline in really on Chief and Cortana, and it's a really, really good, like, very emotionally complex story.
Yeah.
Halo 5, like, was based on a marketing campaign, like, that led into it, that was very much about the idea of, like, has the Chief gone rogue, and okay, all of this. And what it does is it splits the story over two characters. You play as a guy called Locke, and you play as a guy, and you play as the Master Chief, in squads, doing a storyline which involves Locke chasing down Chief to try and effectively arrest him, against this backdrop of... The thing I've quite liked about the Halo mythos is that ultimately it's actually reasonably simple. It's just got very effective kind of archetypes that it works with. Halo 5 goes, like, full sci-fi mumbo-jumbo, like, in a way that just doesn't work for it. It's spectacular in terms of its visuals. It's got some really good, strong visuals. But when it comes then down to the gameplay, because you're in squads, there's just a lot of kind of things that don't work for Halo. Like, there's a lot of, when you die, you end up having to wait for your squad AI to come and pick you up. And the squad AI is bad, so it just, like, ruins and disrupts the flow of the game. They changed a lot of the weaponry designs they added. Halo Infinite does have Zoom now, but Zoom came in Halo 5. And it really disrupts, like, the flow of combat in comparison to the previous Halos. A lot of small things like that. Like, quite frustrating enemy encounter designs. And a really bad structure to the campaign where there's a lot of, like, downtime that just doesn't make sense.
Okay. Mm. It sounded like they went a bit Gears of War with it, in a way.
It's just... I don't
just
know
not
what
for you.
They went.
Yeah. Why don't we talk about something you're very excited about,
yeah,
which is the current
this
Halo.
Builds into what Halo Infinite is, which is... I hesitate to say that it's, like, a complete, like, back to Bungie's ideas, because it's not. It has a certain amount of open world to it, and I don't want to say it, certainly at the point that I've got to, it's not an open world game in the same way that, like, Horizon is or all that stuff. But it certainly borrows a lot of ideas from the likes of Far Cry. But I would say it's a little bit more like doing campaign missions that then lead you into a section of open world that is a bit more... Because obviously the way that a Halo ring is formatted, it's not a massive map, right? They're kind of long strips of land as the Halo ring spins round.
Is it kind of, in a way, more akin to, like, a death loop? It's kind of open, but very linear at the same time?
Maybe, but... So I'll explain how the opening of the game works. I'm not going to talk about story at all, because I don't, you know, like, let's not go there. But you do a couple of campaign missions at the start, which are very much feel like Halo, as in, like, there's no open world there. You're just going from place to place. They're in spaceships and internal designs. And then you get to a point where you come to the Halo ring that this game is about. And then it kind of opens up, and what you've got is you can go to what are called forward operating bases, which, if we were talking like the language of Far Cry, imagine something that's a cross between a very small outpost and a radio tower. So when you go in and you take all the enemies out and you capture that forward operating base for yourself, it puts extra activities on the map, and it's like, hey, we've unlocked all of the things that are in this area. You can go and do the side activities. Those side activities include, there are, like, chests around which have got, like, upgrades for your armor, so you can start to upgrade, like, your grapple hook, or you can upgrade, like, your threat detector, upgrade your overshield. So that's a little bit like how, like, a lot of games have, like, so for example, in Far Cry at the moment, when you find, like, all of the Supremo Bond, which allows you to upgrade your current equipment, that's that equivalent.
But there isn't actual crafting. You're just
No. It's no crafting at all. I like it because it's a bit more straight up. Like, you get what you're given. You go, you find a crate, you open it, it's got an upgrade module that you slot into your armor in whichever one you want, and your armor is now better.
And
are any of those visual?
No. So when you find things in the world, like Master Chief will pick them up, but it's not a case of they're nebulous enough, so it's not like you have picked up a grapple thing. It's like you've picked up a currency that now allows you to make your armor better.
Okay. And am I right in thinking that you told me some of those things are even, like, multiplayer unlockables?
I have found things, that, like, you'll find, like, a locker, and it'll be like, oh, you've found, like, a multiplayer skin.
That's quite cool. So, I mean, it's kind of encouraging people who would only play multiplayer, you might want to play the campaign to get some of the stuff.
Yeah. There's also kind of like groups of Marines, which I think has been shown before in trailers, and you can go and find them, and like they might be either like... Sometimes they're being held hostage by the... I say the Covenant forces. These days, it's the Banished, which are like a splinter faction of the Covenant from the original series. And they'll have them like held hostage, or sometimes they're just kind of lost in the environment, and like you come up and say, hey, come with me, you're going to come back. And doing these little things, and that kind of leads up to... There are then like actual outposts, which are big, kind of... I'm surprised about how big they are, like big fortresses that have got like objectives in them. Mm. You complete those objectives and then you capture that kind of area. This all gives you like... I hesitate to call it a currency because that sounds like it's something else, but you gain these things that it's called valor. So you'll earn a certain amount of points of valor for doing those things. And basically, imagine that the single player has, for lack of a better term, like its own battle pass. So each time you get valor, it unlocks a new thing on this linear path of unlocks. And then when you go to forward operating bases, you can call those items in. So like very early on, you'll unlock the ability to call in a mongoose, which are the ATVs.
Okay.
But then get more valor and you'll be able to say like... So there are like ammo packs around it, but at the start of the game, it only gives you either the assault rifle or the sidekick pistol. But gain enough valor to unlock the... like the commando rifle.
It's almost Metal Gear Solid 5 in that respect.
To a degree, yeah, there's a little bit of those kind of ideas. Yeah, you're earning the more kind of stuff you do to help liberate and explore the Halo Zeta ring. You get more points, which gradually linearly unlocks new things, which when you're going like, okay, I'm going to go and attack this kind of big stronghold outpost, but the stuff that I've got isn't what I want, so I'm going to go to my weapons bin, I'm going to open it, because I've previously unlocked these two weapons, I'm going to choose those two, and then because I've now unlocked the Warthog with the rocket launchers on the back, I'm going to get in that, I'm going to go and get some Marines, they're going to get in the back, they're going to get on the rocket launcher, and I'm going to go and do this. So kind of like, it does that thing that I like in games where systems play into each other.
Yeah.
And so doing one thing allows you to do another thing, which then allows you to be better at this thing.
Amazing. I've got a few questions for you, Matt. There's a few quickfire Halo questions for you. What's the best weapon you've used in the campaign yet, so far?
I have like a massive soft spot still for the assault rifle, and a part of that is...
That's so fucking boring.
I know,
mate.
But part of it is they butchered the assault rifle for Halo 5. Like they completely lowered its rate of fire. It's back to the real nice, sputtery, fast assault rifle. But... There is...
I know you like the grapple. Tell us about the grapple.
So the grapple you can upgrade to put a stun on it. So when you fire it into enemies, it stuns them. Like it's like a taser.
Okay.
And then you pull yourself into them, and as you finish it, you can whack them. But the thing I love so much about the combat... I've spoken quite a lot on the podcast about how much I like Halo's combat because of the interplay between the different types of characters that you're fighting against. Because the world is just a little bit more open and a little bit more kind of wider now, kind of like before Halo would open itself up into big kind of combat arenas, but now those combat arenas don't have boundaries because you're not in a level, it's an open section. Yeah. So there's a lot more space to kind of zip around and like make use of different heights of geography and stuff like that. So the grapple hook plays massively into that and kind of creates a huge amount of chaos. Because what you can do is... Halo has its equivalent of the explosive barrels that you see in so many shooters. But you can fire the grapple hook into those and pull the barrel towards you and then hurl that back at an enemy. And like as you're doing that, you can then like jump to the side and headshot something and boot something so it goes into an explosion as that explosive barrel you've just thrown explodes.
That sounds wicked.
To me, it's almost like... So it's nowhere near as fast as Doom, but it does feel a bit like the chaotic ideas of Doom, which has got like so many things that you're thinking about at any one time, bolted onto like the fundamental ideas of a Far Cry game. But then, whereas Far Cry's, you know, I think Far Cry's main quests are bad. I think they're all very boring. In Halo, a main quest is like a Halo main story mission from the previous games, where they're set in big... like bespoke environments for that mission, with a lot of thoughts about height and sort of like the way that you'll fight within specific regions of that level. And so I kind of think it has found a way to be the best of both a traditional linear campaign, but while also stitching those linear campaign missions together with a more coherent open world.
I say this from only experiencing
four missions. It could all sync, right? Like,
that's what I was going to ask. Like, from you've only played four missions. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm just trying to like. I think a lot of people maybe when they hear the words open world, not that this is fully open world, it's a sort of open world. I imagine a longer game, like you know, a Halo campaign would normally what be 8 to 10 hours, maybe. Mm-hmm. Like, open world games tend to be longer than that. Are you getting the sense that this is longer than your average Halo game?
It's definitely longer than your average Halo game, because I'd say probably to do those four missions, I think it's taken me about 4 hours, but obviously I've also been pottering around the open world. Mm-hmm. But whereas something like Horizon or like an Assassin's Creed, when we think of open world, means that you can go anywhere. Yeah. I have a section of the map unlocked, which means I can only work around in there. I must say, I've not been to the boundaries of that, so I don't know if you can walk past the boundaries, but I get the impression is that each new mission you do unlocks a new section of the Halo ring, and then you can do the open world activities in it. And obviously, like, if you want to power through the campaign, I think the idea is then you'd be able to come back to earlier places and do activities you might not have done. But it definitely feels like the idea is to serve it up a bit more piecemeal than an open world, but still have, like, those numerous activities that an open world would have. But certainly, if I'd been playing it for 4 hours on, like, Halo 3, I'd be halfway through the campaign at this point.
Yeah.
I don't know. I might be halfway through the campaign. It might only be 8 missions long. I get the impression not. It doesn't feel in the story like I'm that far.
I wanted to ask, I'm not sure if you have an answer for this, but from the first gameplay footage that was shown, like, do you think the work of Halo Infinite being delayed, can you see, like, any improvements in the final product? Because I remember, you know, there was, like, a decent backlash from the state of how Infinite looked like and what it might play like as well.
Yeah, so I would say in terms of, like, visuals, I think I've already seen, like, in... Because obviously previews went live this morning.
Yeah, yeah.
I've seen people talking about how it looks like a glorified Xbox One game, which to a degree, like, it is a game that runs on Xbox One. Like, that was the whole idea of it, right? I don't think it is a game that is going to graphically stun anyone. However, I am a fan of what Halo looks like, and this is the best-looking Halo game to date. So Halo has a lot of kind of like iconography that it constantly uses throughout the game, because most of them are set on Halo rings, as the title. Yeah. So Halo rings have a very verdant kind of like northern forests kind of look to its surface. And obviously when you drill deeper underneath the surface of a Halo ring, you then go into Forerunner architecture, which is all very much kind of like angular and the kind of almost diamond shapes that stuff uses. Mm-hmm. I have obviously seen a lot of that now, and to see that like with good modern day reflections on them and see like enemy characters that have much more detail on them.
Yeah.
But they definitely aren't... We're not talking kind of like... God of War, or I mean, I say that as a PlayStation 4 game, but what's something that's come out recently that's just fucking
like Horizon, Forza Horizon?
Yeah. It's not Forza Horizon in terms of like that straight up visual fidelity. I still think it's a good looking game. It's still like when I can climb to like the top of a big like rocky outcrop and just look over the Halo, and then like zoom in on enemies and be able to see good detail, like. It's a pretty game, and it's got like it's a colourful game, and I think I've always admired kind of Halo's colour palette. It's almost to the point of being gaudy, but in kind of like a cool sci-fi way.
Yeah, mixing greens with purples and blues.
I mean, this is all sounding great, and I'm now excited for Halo, having never been really excited for Halo before, because this sounds like what I maybe am into. And like, I think the only disappointment for me, and probably a lot of people, is that they recently. I think I literally just saw us tweet a news story now that. Co-op for this game won't be coming until May at the very earliest, which is a shame, because this sounds like the sort of game that would be amazing to just co-op and like grapple around, just warthog around the map like together. Like it feels like it is to an, and I know It's obviously not built for co-op because it's a single-player campaign, but it feels like elements of this were built with co-op in mind, and that's going to be delayed by, what, at least 5 months now?
Yeah. Co-op's been like a mainstay for like previous Halo games. It's just so weird to not have it there at launch.
Yeah, it's like I've, you know, my replay of Halo this year has all been done in co-op, and like I'm currently playing Far Cry in co-op, which is why I've been like comparing it a lot, because obviously it draws a lot of ideas. And I, fundamentally, I don't actually think Far Cry 6 is all that great, but I am enjoying the format of, I think the format of Far Cry is good for cooperative play. That whole idea of like, you're going to go in from this entrance in this camp, and I'm going to go in from this entrance, and we're going to pincer movement. All of that is fundamentally good co-op fodder. The idea to be able to do that with a much more fluid and engaging combat system in a world that I just think is more engaging than what Far Cry has been able to produce. It is a shame I'm not going to be spending my Christmas playing this in co-op.
Yeah. I mean, the way I see it is play it through this Christmas single player normally, and then maybe when co-op launches, like, that's a good excuse to try it on like Legendary or something with a friend and try and get through it. And assuming the rest of the campaign is brilliant, that is, and it doesn't fall off a cliff. But, you know, we're hopeful. Like, if the multiplayer and the first four missions are aiming to go by, there's no reason to presume that anything is going wrong with this game.
It feels like, to me, kind of like, you know, there are tidbits around the story that you can go and read if that's what you kind of want to find out where it's going, but it feels like it's going back to that slightly more, for the Chief personally, I think a slightly more emotionally complex kind of storyline, but the actual events of what are going on so far, I think, are closer to what the stories that Bungie used to tell. It's much more in the vein of Halo 3. And so I think if you liked those like archetypical sci-fi stories that Bungie used to like to tell about kind of like finding things on remote planets and stuff like that, while also having Chief having to assess his relationship with, you know, where it was with Cortana and how he fits into like, he's an old weary soldier by this point, and I think you're starting to be able to tell that he's kind of,
is he like a bit Old Snake at this point?
Not quite that, because Old Snake is very kind of like, that is the point of those games, but he's getting close to that sort of character. I think kind of like he's just maybe slightly sadder than he used to be, which for a man that's been genetically, you know, built up to be sort of an unthinking soldier, kind of is something I hope that over the space of this campaign it really drills down into that.
Nice. I mean, yeah, it sounds like Halo Infinite is shaping up on the campaign side to be very good, and the multiplayer is already excellent. So, yeah, from one game I previously wasn't really enthused about at all to now just pretty much in love with Halo Infinite, to a series of games I was once in love with and now I've lost all enthusiasm for, the GTA Trilogy Definitive Edition came out last week. And look, I've dabbled in all three of these now, and I won't lie, I'm having fun, because these are fundamentally great games. In many ways they haven't aged well, and these remasters definitely haven't aided that process at all.
I'm just gonna
go through, like, I was originally gonna go through, I plan to go through all three of these games in order and enjoy them fully. I played about 2 hours of GTA 3 and realised, you know what, this is too simple for me at this point. I'm going to have to skip it. Like, I was bored. I played the first couple hours of Vice City. Better. Still into it. Still Vice City. But again, the mission design was a little too simple. And I know Vice City, from memory, gets a lot more interesting the further you get into it. And then I booted up San Andreas, which I think is, for me anyway, leaps and bounds ahead in terms of, especially from the get-go, it's a much better opening than the opening to the other two games. Like, it gets you straight into it and straight into that character. And you're doing, just the fact you start off on a push bike, to me, it's just, I don't know, I've always loved that opening, that it's not just the same, we've got to drive to this place and get someone, and like, whereas it's something a bit different. But obviously, that's not the headlines of GTA Trilogy. Everyone knows these games are historically good. The problem is, and I know, Jesse, you've done a lot of analysis, some would say, on this issue. There's a couple of bugs in this game.
It's mad when you think about it, because, like, I guess the main question is, like, are these definitive editions, like, the ideal way or the best way to play through these games? And ultimately, like, it's a resounding no. It's probably the easiest way to play, because, you know, the older versions have been removed, but with the Definitive Edition, they're not using the PS2 or Xbox era as the foundation. It's the mobile remasters, and then on top of that, it's the PlayStation 3/Xbox 360 versions, all of which, they all had bugs, and that's the like the basis of the Definitive Edition.
It's mad, the more you think about it, that they've used the word definitive.
Yeah.
Just call it the GTA Trilogy Remaster. In fact, you have decided, even probably after testing these, for announcing it, have gone, do you know what? These are the definitive editions of these games.
It's just mad, because there's no cohesion or just any reason in terms of what these games now look like. Like for me, Vice City looks like Simpsons Hit and Run, San Andreas just looks mad, and 3 is just super dark now. It's just, they're kind of just ugly.
Yeah, and I will say, like, a lot of the bugs and glitches you've probably seen online, if you've been paying any attention to this, are like, you know, cars pile into pedestrians, people with mad fingers, like,
stuck in
I
trees.
Don't know. Yeah, just like, yeah, people stuck in trees screaming, planes just exploding out of nowhere. Like, a lot of this stuff when I'm playing GTA, and I remember this as a kid, like, I would find this stuff hilarious. To me, that's just funny. If I saw some pedestrians screaming into a tree, I would laugh. But it's when it gets to the point where, like, it's breaking missions for you. You can't complete missions. Like, it just won't control right. Like, that's where it becomes an issue where, like, those are, like, glitches are funny. Bugs are just annoying.
Yeah, I had, when I was playing through San Andreas the other day, I had a plane out of nowhere spawn mid-cutscene, destroy a car, I had to get in, and the mission failed instantly. And I was like, I'm not sure that ever happened on the PS2.
No, I don't, yeah, like, there'll be lots of, like, it's almost the sort of thing, like, is this something that can just be patched?
I don't think it is, because it's essentially...
It's like fundamental game code, isn't
it? Yeah, it's core to the mobile version, which is like the basis and stuff. I don't think patches... Like, they can probably solve, you know, a few, like, on-surface things, like the really hideous fucking rain in the game and stuff. Yeah. But when it comes to those...
I mean, I think you can fix all this. Like, Cody's not made of, like, concrete that you can't, like, change. It's
no,
just,
but, like, there's some stuff in there that seems so fundamental that I doubt they'll get round to fixing all of this.
It's whether it's cost-effective
exactly.
to fix
that's what I mean,
this.
And it probably isn't. It's like, they'll do a few patches, and then once that's one and done, I don't think they're going to be touching
like, yeah,
this
you're
again.
Never going to... And I personally don't have an issue with the visual style of it. Like, the more cartoony...
It.
Yeah, the more cartoony, like... character models, I don't like some of them do look very odd, that's it. I will admit
the thing
that.
Is,
but
is
overall I don't mind it because they're cartoony games
and that visual style harks back to the front covers of those games. Like, you look at what like the covers of those original games were, they were all done as almost like comic book strips, right? On
the front covers.
So I kind of don't mind that it leans into that, because they were way cartoonier games at that point. They were designed almost like capers, whereas the modern ones are like, you know, odes to Martin Scorsese. Those original ones were much more like dumb and silly and kind of like far more, as you say, kind of cartoony. But it's kind of like the other bits, right, where it goes down the drain.
I thought I'd get these games and I wouldn't be able to put them down, and that's the opposite of what's happened basically. And I'm still going to persevere with San Andreas just because I do love that game and I do want to play through San Andreas. Unfortunately, that does seem the one that's the most affected by mad things happening. But I'm definitely going to carry on with San Andreas. It's just like, and I know there's the argument like, no one's ever telling you need to pre-order a game, but a lot of people will have pre-ordered these games just out of habit because they know, oh, GTA Trilogy, these are games I love. I want to play them like in this new format.
Yeah.
And obviously them not showing the games beforehand to anyone is an issue. Like, but yeah, like, I think it's just, you know, I'm not blaming, like, this is going to sound like I'm blaming the consumer. I'm not at all. Like, it's just a good lesson to learn. And we learned it with Cyberpunk. Don't pre-order games until you've
thing,
seen
right,
them.
Is that like, and especially with Cyberpunk as well? Is that those are two games that come from developers that have got very, very good reputations for releasing some things that are very good. Like, I know Witcher was buggier when it came out, but in general, a GTA when it comes out when it's done. Like, they don't tend to put,
apart from the online, maybe.
But like those campaigns, like GTA 5 came out in a very, very good state. Like Red Dead Redemption 2 came out in a very good state. So we've got used to trusting Rockstar's kind of sense of,
it's just not like them at all to like put this out just like in this state. Like, they normally like wait until they're ready and like they're like, I don't know why they felt... Maybe because the GTA 5 remaster was meant to come out this winter, and they were like, well, we've got to put something out this winter.
Yeah.
We'd rather this be in a bad state than GTA 5 be in a bad state.
This is the thing. It's happened before with the mobile and then PS3/360 era, but no one really noticed because by that point, like, no one really cared that much. It's not like it was advertised as, like, this is the definitive edition. It's just like, hey, there's a few graphical things. That's it. But now, you know, you had that, like, what, one trailer? I swear there was just only one trailer for this.
It was just basically a graphics comparison trailer, wasn't it? That's all it was. Yeah. There was no, like, actual gameplay. It was
actual gameplay.
Engine, but, yeah. It's just disappointing, isn't it? And yeah. Like I said, I'm going to still play San Andreas through gritted teeth because it is ultimately still better than getting my PS2 out from, I don't know, where it is in my loft somewhere and hooking that up and playing it there.
Yeah.
But... like that is the like there are positives to it. Like it does control a lot better. Like I like that they have the modern controls, and driving specifically is a lot better in that game. The shooting, questionable whether that's much better, but
yeah,
like they do control better. There's auto saves, you can restart missions. There are some pluses to this,
yeah,
but
for sure.
As a whole package, it is just disappointing, isn't it?
Yeah,
and I don't like being disappointed. I don't like talking about things that disappoint me, but there we go. Maybe you can lighten the mood, Jesse, because you... and I still haven't seen this film, and I'm excited to go see it. You have seen the new Ghostbusters, Ghostbusters Afterlife.
I certainly have. So,
you don't sound infused. I want you to sound infused.
No, like, so this thing, like, Ghostbusters is this weird thing where, like, when, I think, what, the 2016 film? Was it in 2016? So, yeah, like,
17, around then.
When that was coming out and stuff, like, for me, anyway, as a kid, I have no real memories of, like, OG Ghostbusters films. Like, I watched them as a kid, but they didn't leave, like, any... long-lasting impressions or any, like, nostalgia in me and stuff. So I went into Afterlife with somewhat of a fresh mind and, like, really, really enjoyed it. Like, I haven't really watched a film like that in a while that just left me, you know, smiling because it's a cute film, it's funny, and it's just, like, pleasant to watch. And I think the new cast as well, because the film focuses on, I think her name is McKenna Grace.
Yes, and it's Spengler's kids.
I thought she was really, really good in the film. And, like, if they end up making a sequel to... you know, another sequel to Ghostbusters, it'll be great to have sort of just like this young kind of like teenager cast, not quite Stranger Things, because that's, you have a little bit of a vibe
from the trailers. Have you seen the film Super 8, the J.J. Abrams?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Matt, you're nodding.
I love Super 8. I think it's cracking.
It's a really good film. It's a forgotten film. People don't remember it. But yeah, I was getting that sort of vibes from it, like group of kids like stumble across something they shouldn't have sort of thing, and alien threat. In many ways, like, remind me of the original Ghostbusters from the trailer, but also like an 80s Spielberg, like an E.T. or something. And yeah, I'm excited. Like when a lot of the reviews came out like a month or so ago, I saw a lot of people just like trashing it, going like, this is it, cash in on nostalgia and stuff.
I mean,
but I've seen a lot of people have watched and gone, do you know what? It's actually quite heartwarming and I like it. So.
I think that issue there where people are saying it's a bit of a cash in, although I don't have many memories of the original Ghostbusters, there's certainly an element towards the end of the film that feels like that. It's a bit kind of like Rogue One CGI kind of stuff, where they do something like that.
Okay.
And like it felt a little bit cheap to me, but it didn't really ruin the entire film for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking for, like, is it... I'm trying not to... like, I don't know how well you were... remember the original Ghostbusters, but like, is it sort of a Force Awakens thing where they've just taken that plot line and done it again, or are they doing something different?
That's the thing, I really don't remember the first film.
Right,
I don't
let
remember
me outline,
like, if, I don't remember
the original,
if the first film is
1980,
like
1980, can't remember when Ghostbusters
is it, like a full-on comedy, the first film, because I can't remember.
There's basically a satire, like and this is the weird thing with Ghostbusters, like, they've kind of, nowadays it's kind of considered this like family thing, whereas back in the day, like, the original film, It's like a satire. It's not like kids enjoyed Ghostbusters, but like it's not a kid's film necessarily. Like, it's a satire with like some like quite adult jokes in there at times.
Okay.
As well. Like,
yeah.
And nowadays, because obviously that is transformed into something else. There was the animated show that a lot of people loved, and like these days it is kind of, and they're definitely positioning this one as it's led by kids as like a big like family thing. But that's like where these films kind of like these doings of 80s stuff kind of like fall, like I'm sure it's enjoyable, but it's like, who is the target audience here? Because you're doing a kids film, whereas really if you're trying to aim for that nostalgia, you should be aiming for people in their 30s, 40s, 50s who love Ghostbusters, whereas actually you're targeting this at their kids who have no nostalgia for Ghostbusters whatsoever. So it's kind of caught in this middle ground where I think this film will do well, and I'm intrigued to see what like the general public think, because sometimes, you know, film critics can be a bit snooty and kind of waiting for that chance to like rip into something that is just seemingly a cash grab. But it seems like, especially because this is directed by Jason Reitman, who is Ivan Reitman's son, who directed the original Ghostbusters. From listening to him talk about his film, like, it's a real personal project for him, and like he's like always wanted to do this. He obviously grew up around the original Ghostbusters, and like, so yeah, it feels like I'm hoping for a film full of heart, basically.
Yeah, it's got like, it's when I was watching it, it just felt like, because I was in a just screening by myself, I never really had that experience where I could just watch the film in complete, you know, silence and just absorb everything. It just felt like a nice kind of summer holiday film of, like, you know, this family going to this new location and the kids are meeting, like, you know, everyone in town and stuff, and they're coming together to, like, for this big adventure. Kind of felt like the Goonies in that way, I guess. But it's just a nice film with, you know, funny beats and a bit of heart, I guess.
Nice. I'm gonna see it. I think this one is cinemas only. Do you know that, Matt? I'll look up now. I don't think it's on streaming anyway.
I think nothing's going to stream. We've finished the era of streaming, haven't we?
HBO Max films. I think some HBO Max films are still there. Isn't The Matrix HBO Max Day?
I thought Dune was the last of the HBO Max.
Was it? Maybe I'm wrong. Who knows? We don't have HBO Max anyway, so everything's cinema for us.
I thought it's in the UK now.
Not yet, is it? It's coming soon. But anyway.
Yeah.
There we go. Ghostbusters. Let us know what you think of Ghostbusters if you've seen it. IGN_UK feedback@IGN.com. I've actually got the whole of next week off. Maybe I'll try and go and see Ghostbusters.
You should. It's fun.
Yeah, there we go. I've never seen the original Ghostbusters in a cinema, so it's been my first Ghostbusters cinema experience. I tell you what I did see, though, last week is a film that I can now talk about that's out in America next week in limited cinemas. I think like it might only be out in like New York and LA, and then in December it's out everywhere. But it's not out till January in the UK. So I'll mention it again in January. But I saw Licorice Pizza, which is Paul Thomas Anderson's latest film.
Such a gross title.
Nah. There's nothing bad about this film.
Before we go any further,
yes.
Does Licorice Pizza mean anything within the context of the film?
So Licorice Pizza is the name of an old record shop that used to be in LA.
Right.
So that's like, there is no licorice or pizza in the film. Spoilers. Like, it's not about the food. What I will say is, and people may want to take my opinions on this film with a pinch of salt, because I am a self-confessed Paul Thomas Anderson, I don't know, I don't want to say fanboy, because I hate that word, but like, he's basically my hero. Like, any film he comes out with, I will watch and probably love. Like, there'll be Bud's my favorite film of all time. Boogie Nights, The Master, I think all in my top 10. Like, love his films. Licorice Pizza is the best film I've seen since There'll Be Blood. Like, it's the best film of the last 14 or 15 years. And it's all very raw. I've only saw it a week ago, but I have wanted to watch it again ever since I saw it. If you don't know what it is set in the 1970s in LA. It's about Alana Kane, who is played by Alana Haim from the band Haim. It's her first ever performance in a film, and she is unbelievable. She's basically playing a woman in her mid-20s who's kind of a bit lost, a bit wandering in the world. She's kind of her, when we meet her in the film, she is basically taking children's photos on a school photo day. And at this school photo day, she meets Gary Valentine, who is played by Cooper Hoffman, the son of the late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman. And this is his first ever film role, and he is also unbelievably good.
Wow.
And basically, he is playing this 15-year-old boy who basically asks this mid-20s woman out for a date. He's a very confident, entrepreneurial young man. And basically, for the next 2 hours, 10 minutes, you are going with these, with this couple who are, it's kind of a whole will they, won't they, like, are they just very good friends thing, through, I don't know, a series of months, if not a couple of years, through LA in the 70s, with events happening around them, and just kind of the capers they get in together. And it's just a very funny romantic comedy, I suppose, is what you'd call it. And it's by far his funniest films. The way I've kind of compared it, if you've seen Boogie Nights, It's a much sweeter Boogie Nights with a lot more heart and a lot less cocaine.
Mm.
And I can't get enough of this film. As usual, some amazing needle drops from Paul Thomas Anderson. Just some great songs. You've got like Wings, David Bowie, like The Doors. Like it's just. I would, if I could talk about this film for about 2 hours. It's just. I think in particular, if I know you, Matt, you might love this film. I don't know if you particularly love Paul Thomas Anderson's films.
I like Paul Thomas Anderson a lot. Like the same with you, kind of like There Will Be Blood was my favourite film of the year that it came out, which considering the competition it got, because like No Country for Old Men came out that year
and
as well.
Zodiac. Yeah. It was a good year.
But an absolutely tremendous piece. Also, a lot funnier than a lot of people give that film credit for.
His films are very funny. Mm-hmm. There'll Be Blood is quite funny. Phantom Thread hilarious. Is very funny. Yeah. But this one is definitely going for all that. It's got those, like, I actually rewatched Inherent Vice yesterday, which was his film that never quite hit for me. Mm-hmm. Like, I like it, I just don't love it anywhere near as much as other films. But it's got the best bits from that, which are like, just, like, you've got these two main characters, and Alana and Gary, who are just like the emotional core of it. And then like these other mad characters just kind of interwoven between them. Like you've got Sean Penn in there, you've got Bradley Cooper. Mm-hmm. They just come in for like 10, 15 minutes and just kind of steal everything. And they're just playing these caricatures who are just hilarious.
It sounds to me as if it's got the side of PTA that I like a lot. Because so I know that you like this film a lot, Cardi, but I don't is The Master. And The Master is very, very like heavy and very yeah, like you'll shout at me all you want. I shouted at you last week, but for me The Master's like very kind of serious and very mm-hmm. heavy, and it's got some slight quirks to it, but the subject matter it's dealing with almost doesn't allow it to have
there's almost no comedy in
that. Whereas I really like that thing of like the PTA will always have like a through line, and like you say, like threads. These characters that aren't in it for very long, like there's, mm-hmm. you know, in There Will Be Blood, there's the weird kind of guy that suddenly turns out he's like been impersonating and that. Like, I like these things that come in for kind of like a 10 minute mm-hmm. arc.
I mean, like Boogie Nights and Magnolia do that best because they're like basically like odes to the old like Robert Altman films mm-hmm. of like Nashville and stuff like that. And
I feel like I need to see these films.
Oh, well, it's because he's the best filmmaker of our generation, Jesse.
I mean, I remember when you forced me to watch There Will Be Blood on a plane.
I was sitting next to you on a plane for 11 hours and you couldn't get out of the aisle unless you watched it. So, and to be fair, watching There Will Be Blood on a plane screen is not the most ideal place to watch it, but I'm glad you did it anyway.
It's a very good film. I really enjoyed it.
But yeah, I'll probably talk about Licorice Pizza again in January just to remind people it's out, because I want everyone to see this film, because I like, with no hyperbole whatsoever, I like, it is one of the greatest films I've ever seen. Like, I think I prefer it to Boogie Nights, which is a big thing for me. Like, this, yeah, it's just unbelievable.
Also, well, since we're talking about Paul Thomas Anderson, I've got, like, an anecdote from when I saw There Will Be Blood in the cinema for the second time that, like, I've never had opportunity to talk about on this podcast. So
go
I'm gonna
on.
Say it now. There was a guy, like, this was, like, maybe about 4 weeks into There Will Be Blood being out, so I'd seen it in its first week. And so there weren't many people in the cinema, but I convinced some friends that, like, had never seen a PTA film before to go and see it. And there was a guy about five rows in front of us that I'm fairly convinced had probably just gone into the cinema, just looked at the names of the films that were on and chosen this. And so was probably convinced it was, like, either an action film or a horror film or a revenge plot or something like that.
Yeah.
And the opening to There Will Be Blood is obviously like about 15 minutes of like no
there's
talking.
No dialogue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just a man
with a pickaxe
mining for silver, right? Is at the start of the first one. And this guy is obviously getting like increasingly like agitated that nothing's going on. And then you know he sets the dynamite off and accidentally collapses himself and falls down. This guy leapt out of his seat and started doing like gang signs in the air.
What?
He was so excited by the fact that something had happened. And then obviously like within the next half an hour he leaves the cinema and doesn't come back. But just such a beautiful...
He was expecting a lot more blood.
He would have got it if he'd stayed to the end.
Okay. Yeah, everyone watch all of Paul Thomas Anderson's films.
Are there any films of his that you should avoid?
No.
Fair enough.
Like, they're all at least good. Like, my least favourites are Inherent Vice, because that one just meanders and kind of... I like the first half of that film a lot. Kind of goes nowhere, I think.
Magnolia is like on seven. For more than 3 hours.
Nah, oh, wow. slightly less than
isn't
three.
Magnolia, I'm fairly sure, is like 188 minutes, which puts it 8 minutes over 3 hours.
Nah. I love that film.
It's Lord of the Rings shit.
Like, I don't think it has less than the seven. Like, Punch Drunk Love is also, like, on the lower end for me, but still very good. But, yeah. Well, he's just, to name after one of his films, he is the master. So there you go. And Licorice Pizza, I think, is probably his most accessible film yet that anyone will enjoy. So, yeah, I hope it does really well and everyone sees it and it wins every award possible. So it's winning all of mine. To continue my niche section of things that couldn't be more up my alley, the Radiohead exhibition dropped on PlayStation 5 yesterday. And those are words I never thought I'd say. Also, did anyone see that yesterday? I think it appeared in Fortnite or in the code of Fortnite that there is some Radiohead stuff in Fortnite.
Oh my god.
Because obviously the exhibition is done with Epic Games. So, like, there was, like, I don't know, some unlockables that were like a Radiohead album cover or something.
I mean, it is the ultimate way to promote your stuff by this point.
But, like, this is, if I had to pick any band in the world that wouldn't want anything to do with Fortnite, I would have picked Radiohead. But then again, you never know what Radiohead are going to do next. So
maybe
like,
they're
the
just
same
sold
time.
Out. Maybe it's happened, Cardi.
They're
maybe
not
Radiohead
sold,
have sold out.
Out. Maybe they're trying to reach a new... They're trying to get Amnesiac into the hands of the 10-year-olds.
Getting it into the fucking metaverse. Jesus yeah. Christ.
Yeah, maybe, like, I don't know, who played, like, Ninja. Maybe he's going to get really into, like, motion picture soundtrack and really listen to it all the time. I don't know. But anyway, Radiohead Kid Amnesia. I'm going to call it Kid Amnesia. Basically, it's the 20th and 21st anniversary of the albums Kid A and Amnesiac from Radiohead. Two fantastic albums. Kid A is an all-timer. Amnesiac, very good. Not on the same level for me. But, yeah, basically, this exhibition is... They did... another thing I never thought I'd see is Tom York wrote a PlayStation blog post yesterday, which basically detailed what this is, which is 2 years ago they basically had plans to do like a real in-life exhibition.
Mm.
Ideally, they wanted to do it like the Victorian Albert Museum or somewhere like that. But obviously, their ambitions were too high, so they couldn't do it. Then COVID hit, so they couldn't really do it. So they thought, let's do it digital. So they got in touch with some game developers and have made this kind of virtual exhibition that you can walk around that kind of is got really lots of like I've forgotten the name of the artist who does a lot of their album artwork, but he's basically that's all of his art in there, and lots of like there's lots of obviously songs from the albums, but also lots of like stems and weird things happening. So they got like all the different like music tracks, the different instrumental tracks from each of the album, and kind of mix them together so weird things are happening. And like, I'm not gonna like, if you don't like Radiohead or you're not really into walking around cool art exhibits, this isn't for you. I'm not telling people to do it, but if you haven't, just in case you're a Radiohead fan or you want something cool to spend, I don't know, hour and a half walking around on your PlayStation, it's just a cool place to be. It's quite visually weird at times and almost bordering on horror at times. Like, there's some odd things going on.
I was gonna ask, is it like an interactive album? Like, can you actually hear all the tracks?
You can't hear all the tracks. Like, basically it's like you're in a museum exhibition. Like, there'll be signs on the wall saying, oh, go left this way,
okay,
for the
yeah.
for the National Anthem exhibition, and like you'll walk into this weird orange gelatinous pyramid and you'll hear the bass and drums from the song National Anthem, which is just incredible. Like, there's weird things going on. And like, they played, like, there's a bit near the end where they play a couple of songs, and I was getting weirdly emotional because I have my earphones on full blast and I was walking around just like floating in this space with like weird things happening around me.
Yeah.
I don't know. Kid A means a lot to me. So
the thing that I want to know, Cardi, is
yeah,
how much of it is just like, oh, we wanted to make this exhibition and we planned out an exhibition, so what we're going to do is just make a virtual exhibition, and how much of it actually takes advantage of the fact that you're in a digital space, and therefore
so a lot of it takes, like, there's bits where you obviously like, oh, you're just walking down a hallway to find the next exhibit, but a lot of it, yeah, it's digital. Like, you're just like floating in midair and weird things are happening around you. Like, yeah, like this couldn't have been done physically.
I'd seen some screenshots which made it look very much like you were in a room with tables with things on it and things on the wall, and it's like that feels from my perspective like it's not making the most of the fact that you're doing it in a video game
space. So like, you're not, there's no gameplay or anything. You can move and you can sprint with R1, mm-hmm. you can zoom in with L1. Like, there are a few bits where there's just like some sketches on a wall you can look at, but for the most part, something weird is happening around you. There's a bit where it's kind of hidden away in a corner downstairs. There's the, it's called the Little Cinema, where you can just go in and it'll randomly play like some live tracks from like shows they've done. And like,
are you ever like reading information like, oh, like,
you're never like reading things. It's all
it's just purely audio visual. Right.
Like, if you're not into Radiohead, you might not be into this, but if you're into something weird and cool to do for an hour on your PlayStation or on PC, it's free to download. You don't have to pay for it. It's all free. So just maybe give it a go. Stick some headphones on. It did make me wish it was in VR, because that would be ridiculously cool to do in VR, I think. But yeah, as a Radiohead nerd, I was into it.
That does sound really cool.
Give it a go. Maybe you'll enjoy it. You know what? And if you're not into Radiohead, give it a go. Maybe you'll discover the joys of Radiohead. Who knows? Maybe you'll have a cry. Do you know what makes some people cry because they find it tediously boring, but we enjoy it? The Endless Search. Inside, it's a UK IGN crew. Yeah, on the ones and twos. We got the games gonna play for you. Inside, I got a question for you. Hold tight, the DJ, we're coming through. Yeah, on the ones and twos. We got the games gonna play for you. Inside, I got a question for you. It's the Endless Search. This week, I've got a quick Endless Search to do, and this one has been sent in from Leo Yang. Thank you, Leo. And he has done us some questions for the Endless Starch. If you don't remember what the Endless Starch is, it's where we take a game and change one letter in that game's name. Jesse is shaking his head because he's probably scared.
I can't remember if I've ever won any of these before. I don't think I have.
But basically, we're running short on time anyway, but I've picked out five of the questions that Leo sent in for us that I think are good, and we'll do those five and see who wins. So there's going to be a clue here for a game. I think the example I always use is loads of rodents in an open world Miami setting, and then the answer is GTA MyC, something like that. So you just change one letter and you get a different game name. Let's try it. So, the first question for you is, two intergalactic furries are stuck in transit in between floors. What could it be?
Intergalactic furries.
Two intergalactic furries are stuck in transit in between floors. I will say, this is a game that came out this year.
God.
When you say a game that came out this year, not a re-release of games that came out.
No, no, it's a new game that came out this year. They're almost inter-universal. Multiversal furries are stuck in between floors. Think of some furry characters that maybe had a game this year.
Okay.
Oh, Jesse's onto something.
Can you give me the clue again, please?
Two intergalactic furries are stuck in transit in between floors.
What the fuck?
I know what game it is, but I'm trying to figure out.
Do you?
I'm certain I do.
It depends if you want to reveal it and then Matt'll steal it or not.
I'll make this a lot shorter.
And you say the game has got furries in it. That's because I thought that was the thing you were making
up. Not actual furries, but furry characters. Yeah. The lead character.
Ratchet and Clank Lift Apart.
It is. There we go.
I literally then had to open up my list of games I've played this year, and I was like, which one of these could have this in? And I just got to Ratchet and Clank.
Well, there we go. Please put your phone away in future.
Look at lists of games?
Jesse used his brain power. And Jesse's got a point. It's 1-0 to Jesse. The next one is...
brain power.
Hordes of zombies steal your cash the day your employers gave it to you. Hordes of zombies steal your cash the day your employers gave it to you.
Are these games released this year?
No, this one was not.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, none of the other games were released this year.
Oh, wicked.
A lot of zombie games. It doesn't really narrow that down. I will say this is a PlayStation exclusive game. Hordes of zombies steal your cash the day your employers gave it to you. A PlayStation 4 exclusive.
Yes.
I know which one it is.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out what the title is.
Oh, there's only two words. Hordes of zombies steal your cash the day your employers gave it to you. And I hope you're not thinking of the wrong game.
surely it's... It's Days Gone, isn't it? I'm just trying to figure out.
Right. Yeah. And if your cash had gone the day your employers gave it to you, what would have happened? Something will have gone.
Oh, pay's gone.
Pay's gone.
Oh,
there we go.
Fuck's sake.
There we go.
Pay's gone.
We got there. One
brilliant.
Jesus.
I was focusing on the gone part, to be fair.
Yeah, that I was as well.
Okay, well, I thought that was one of the easier ones, so let's see where we go now.
Oh,
one all.
Shit.
Okay. Open world survival where you seek one alcoholic establishment after another. Maybe I'll add some clues to this one. Let me just look up.
So,
I'd say a survival game that takes place underwater where you seek one alcoholic establishment after another.
Pub Nautica.
It is Pub Nautica. There we go. 2-1 to Matt. Two more. An engineer fights off hordes of undead in a search for zen and inner peace. Ooh. I can see Matt's eyes are thinking.
Mm.
Jesse's looking worried.
I'm looking sad, more.
I know the game, but I'm now trying to think how I convert it.
I don't even know what
engineer.
Game
is. Do you know what game it is, Jesse?
No.
You definitely will have played this game. An engineer fights off hordes of undead in a search for zen and inner peace.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Good. Not many games where you play as an engineer.
Yeah, that's true.
He's trying to find zen and inner peace. He's trying to get somewhere. He's trying to get in a new... I don't know. I will say it's the first word that has changed.
Okay, right.
Yeah. Headspace.
It's Headspace. There we go.
Isn't there an app called Headspace?
Yeah.
As well, yeah.
I don't know. There we go. 2-0, it's come down to this, and what a thriller we've had. here we go. This one, do you know what? This one you might get quickly, who knows? I don't want to say too much. A native Australian marsupial loses it and commits fatalities on any living being.
Oh, wow. I know what game that is.
I don't know if you do, because I think you're assuming it's something else.
Mortal Wombat.
It is Mortal Wombat. There we go. 3-2 to Matt. And I would say that was painless. We got there in the end. That's the important thing. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to some of your feedback, which, of course, you can send into IGN_UKfeedback@ign.com. Matthew.
Got one here from Ed, who says, hello and thank you for the segment this week, presumably last week, where Joe and Cardi faced off bringing hidden games from the Wii and PS3 back catalogues to the podcast. I congratulate Joe for his picks of Zack and Wiki, Riven Paradise and Deadly Creatures. They're all great games. But I wanted to bring some attention to my arguably better hidden gems for the Wii.
Congratulations for me.
Yeah.
I did note there. Mm-hmm. So that's fine. Turns out Deus Ex, some people don't think is a hidden gem. There we go.
Anyway.
You suggested Deus Ex.
Look, I'm not going through this again. Listen to the podcast, mate.
Dokapon Kingdom, Mr. PAL Release, this four-player board game puts players against each other and the board in a lengthy role-playing quest to defeat monsters and free the land of evil. The script is bizarre and hilarious, and when you defeat a player in a rock-paper-scissors battle, you can rename them or mess up their hair. Then
I've
there's
never heard of that.
No, me neither. Boom Street, also known as Fortune Street, a Monopoly-style board game with stocks and shares market manipulation wrapped in a Mario and Dragon Quest skin. Superb, even included online play. Then Disaster Day of Crisis, which This seems like a Jesse one, because this feels a bit like Disaster
Report. Disaster Report.
We've got the next email is all about Disaster Day of Crisis as well, so I'm going to put in two people. We only got a few emails in about hidden Wii games. Two people came with Disaster Day of Crisis.
It's a good game.
Yeah. Ed says, I think this only had a PAL and Japanese release, no NTSC, so not in America. It threw every conceivable use of the Wiimote into the game, from medical operations, point and shoot, driving, I forget the rest. The story had you outrunning natural disasters one minute, only to meet them head on the next. It was hilarious cheese on a scale only video games can reach, and definitely more than the sum of its many parts. It gives an honourable mention to Dead Space Extraction, an on-rail shooter I worked on with Eurocom for EA. Fun times, love to all those guys. There we go, that's it, and respect the sea. Well, he says R to the C. I assume that means respect the sea.
Yeah. I completely forgot about Dead Space Extraction, that was a thing. That was the weird thing where the Wii would have those weird sort of almost spin-offs of core games. Do you want to... I'm intrigued by the four-player board game one. Was it Dokapon Kingdom?
Dokapon Kingdom.
That sounds mad. I'm intrigued by that. Thank you, Ed. Jesse, you've got one, which, like I said before, we've got more Disaster Day of Crisis talk, which I'm sure you can tell us all about.
That is nuts. This is from Sam Davies. He says, hi all, just wanted to let you know about what I consider the most hidden of hidden gems. I've never heard of or seen anyone else ever talking about or playing this game. The game is called Disaster Day of Crisis. I like to think whoever created the game walked into the head of studio office and said, I want to make a game that's a cross between The Rock, Volcano, Dante's Peak, The Day After Tomorrow, San Andreas, and Greenland. Then added in even more stuff from there. The game is so crazy there isn't one way to describe the minute-to-minute gameplay, and the Wii controller was perfect for this. One minute you'll be in third-person mode running around an area, giving CPR, lifting things off trapped people, and even getting smoke out of your lungs was a big part of the game. Then all of a sudden you're in first-person mode driving away from a tsunami. Probably the only thing that I wasn't particularly keen on was there was large on-rail shooter sections, but they're quite good and there's a good RPG-style system with weapon upgrades. At one point you even fight a bear. What a game. The trailers do it so much justice. The music is so good. Hopefully you can get a copy of this game and give it a go.
Let's just stop there, because what the hell... Like, Jesse, you said you've played this game.
I have. So there was a time when I was like hunting through some like PlayStation 2 games and stuff before we get to Disaster Day of Crisis, and I found this series called Disaster Report, which is like from these Japanese developers, and they pretty much made a game where it's... You're stuck on this island or in a city, and there's like a tsunami happening and earthquakes, and you're basically just trying to survive, and that's pretty much it. And Disaster Day of Crisis like takes up to a whole other level, because I think it's been ages since I've played it, but that feels way more anime than these other games as well, where you're like run away from volcanoes and shit like that. It's pretty ridiculous.
Where are the on-rail shooters? So who are you shooting?
I think there's like eco-terrorists or something. That's usually the plot, or something mad. It's like one of my favorite kind of subgenres of like survival games is escaping from like a destroyed volcanos. City and stuff. You just don't see it.
Volcano escape games is your favorite genre.
Well, no, because like every survival game is like, you know, usually horror and stuff like that. But this is just you're escaping from a city that's, you know, suffering from friggin' earthquakes and tsunamis and all this other madness.
I'm definitely going to look up some gameplay of this game once I finish recording.
It is pretty nuts. But if you're into that game, you should definitely check out Disaster Report, because that game has like four titles in the series and it's very good. And also they have a spin-off game as well that was released on the PS4, and that has like you same setup as Disaster Report. It's called City of Giant Shadows, only released in Japan, but this time you're trying to escape whilst in a city and it's being attacked by Godzilla, Ultraman, Evangelions and shit. So it's Disaster Report but with kaiju and monsters.
Wow.
Same premise.
There we go.
It's still pretty sick.
I knew having Jesse on this podcast would be a plus, because we could go through all the different natural disaster and kaiju escape games.
They're really good, and more should be made. But Sam goes on to say, also, I watched Red Notice at the weekend, and it's definitely one of the worst films I've ever seen. I'd say this year has produced three of the worst films I've ever seen: The Tomorrow War, Army of the Dead, and now Red Notice. It got me thinking, is this the worst year for movies in recent memory? Thanks for the hours of entertainment, Sam.
I have not seen any of those films. I've heard a lot of them are bad.
I've seen Army of the Dead, and I don't mind it.
Well, there we go. I would say it's not the worst year of movies we've ever had, because we have got Licorice Pizza, which is one of the best ones ever made. So it can never be one of the worst years for movies. But yeah, thinking about it, I've not seen, what, apart from Licorice Pizza in June, there aren't many films that have really stood out. I haven't seen a lot of... there's a lot of good films coming out around now that I do want to see.
Is Red Notice the new film with The Rock?
Yeah, and Gal Gadot
and
Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah, it looks... Yeah.
Just...
It's not my whatever. Jam, definitely.
Also, The Tomorrow War looks just absolutely bog standard plain shit. And also, I just don't want to watch Chris Pratt be an action hero still. I just find him a bit boring now.
I saw the trailer for The Tomorrow War and it looks... Can you remember... Battle for LA, I think
yes.
it was.
Yeah.
Just looked like that all over again.
Did you ever play the game for that?
I did not, Jesse.
No.
Didn't.
The trailer for Battle for LA was enough to convince me not to have anything to do with that.
Yeah, what a shit film.
There we go. Thanks for that, Sam. And we've got one here from Andy Wood, who says, "Hi, guys. I've been meaning to write this one in during the fantastic It's Football Day episodes." That was the Football Manager spin-off we did, which I know people occasionally do ask. No plans for that to come back soon. I'm sorry. We're far too busy. But who knows? Maybe one day we'll do something. I don't know. I'm not promising anything, and that is not a promise, so do not take it as a promise. But anyway, Andy goes on to say, "And thankfully, the recent topic... of making up your own challenges in games has given me another opportunity. I usually play the mobile version of Football Manager, like Dale Driver, and I think he's already deep into this year's mobile version of Football Manager, which seems to be infinitely easier than the full fat version on PC. It's not as good though, Andy. It's all about that PC version. After romping my way to a third Premier League title with Dulwich Hamlet, I decided I need a new challenge." I mean, that is quite an achievement, though. "Enter Ned Flanders Football Manager."
Wow.
"The rules for Ned Flanders Football Manager are simple enough. You make a new club and a new stadium. Leftorium FC and the Leftorium are my choices. In the lowest league available in your chosen country." This is a hard enough challenge as it is. "Next, you instantly release any right-footed heathen who dare be a part of the club's initial roster. Only lefties are welcome here." I'm all for this because I am indeed left-handed and left-footed, so I would be able to play as player-manager in this team, so that's good. "Ridiculously, I still managed to make it to the top of FM Mobile in around a decade, even with this restriction, but it made for a fun way to experience the game. Especially my short and dramatic failure as England boss when I tried to apply the Leftorian philosophy to international football. Turns out the fans don't like it when you bin off all the star players for lefty regens from League 2. Anyway, thanks for the fantastic podcast each and every week, and please continue to respect the C diddly E." A lovely, lovely touch on respect that you see there. Who are your guys' favourite left foot footballers around at the moment?
Absolutely none of us. Dumbest question to ask us.
go on. Name a left footed footballer.
Oh fuck, man, I don't know.
To be fair, if you just said Messi, he is left footed, so you could have just said the most famous footballer.
Wayne
I like
Rooney.
This sort of challenge. I might try it. I might not go all the way to the extent because I do play the full version. I might not go down to, like, you know, creating an own club right down the bottom, but I might play as a team like Spurs or someone and think, Could I win the league with just left-footed players? I'm sure I could. I mean, there's some good players out there. Like, I could sign Dusan Blažević. I could get Bale back. It's not bad. It's just it's rarer for, you know, probably, I don't know, one in 10 footballers are maybe left-footed. So you just have a lot less options to pick from, basically.
Right.
Like, you couldn't have, you know, most professional footballers are two-footed. Like, they can use both foot, but they'll have a predominant foot. So, like, you know, it's like, I don't know, yeah, it'd be mad. It's like IGN saying, yeah, we're actually going to sack our stuff and only have left-handed writers from now on for no real reason. I'd be fine, but there we go.
Yeah, would that affect typing much? I don't know.
I don't know. It was a complete, you know, theory. It was, you know, we're not going to put this into practice, don't worry.
I think we should.
I don't know, maybe I'll talk to Pear about that. Maybe we will get that rule enforced. Anyway, write in your feedback to IGN_UK feedback. @ign.com. God, we've got so much, like, for music to end this podcast. We've got Radiohead, we've got the Licorice Pizza soundtrack, we've got Ghostbusters, we've got the whole of the GTA trilogy soundtrack, and then we've got the Halo music. I mean,
should you just layer them all up at once?
We've got some of the best music ever made to choose from here. I don't know what we should go for. I'm going to let... Do you know what, Matt? I'm going to let you decide. What do you think it should be?
Well, it's... What's going to be on the thumbnail is clearly going to be Halo, right? Like, get that Halo main theme going.
We'll get the Halo
Get Breaking main Benjamin theme in. There we go.
Why Halo are Breaking 2. Benjamin going to be in there?
Because Halo 2.
Yeah, Halo 2.
Did they do that?
They well, did, there we go. Yeah. That Halo 2 has got a rocking soundtrack. It's like
it really does.
The Halo, original Halo orchestral theme shows, tunes done as like guitar.
It shows how little I know about Halo 2 that Breaking Benjamin did a soundtrack for it. I mean, I've got so much to learn and I'm looking forward to jumping into Halo further. Thank you, sexy gentlemen, for joining me for this.
Thank you
podcast.
So much.
There we go. Yeah, here's some Halo, not the Breaking Benjamin version.
Stranger, I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the Heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.